just to be on record, I enjoy my vegetables, and plants need CO2. So I want to make sure we still have plenty of CO2 out there so we have green grass and green vegetables growing, because we need CO2. We can't eliminate all CO2. So I think we're going to have an interesting debate for those that want to produce something that's actually needed by our environment, because claiming that they're improving the environment.
It is Friday, February 22nd, 2019, and yes, that was
Daryl.
Welcome to Raging Chickens Out the Coop podcast. It's been a long time since we've got to feature good old Daryl on the podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week I talk to our capital muckraker in chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. Today's show, Run Bernie Run. Bernie Sanders officially threw his hat into the presidential race this week. His campaign raised $5.9 million from 223,047 individuals in its first 24 hours. That's millions of dollars more than any other Democratic Party candidate thus far. Democratic Party, by the way, is going to make him sign a pledge. All the candidates sign a pledge, just like Trump had signed a pledge. He's going to run as a Democrat. West Virginia teachers have another successful two-day strike. They beat back attempts to introduce charter schools across the state. Oakland teachers walked out on Thursday demanding smaller classrooms, charter school oversight, more school nurses, and guidance counselors. Oakland is one of the epicenters of the charter school billionaire takeover. What is going on? Well, we can tell you this about these uprisings. Rank-and-file progressive caucuses have a lot to do with that. That's right. Take over power, folks. North Carolina Election Board calls for a new vote on the congressional race in which the Republican candidate and his campaign committed what looks like to normal people as systemic voter fraud. More conjecture on the status of the Mueller probe. What this could mean. We think that this might be. While Trump officials apparently tried to sell nuclear tech to Saudi Arabia, it's always good. As if to add insult to injury, Trump is preparing to launch a presidential committee on climate security to determine if climate change is actually a national security threat like the Pentagon says it is. The Washington Post reports that Trump wants the committee to be led by a climate denier, William Happer, who says CO2 is not a pollutant, it's an asset. And actually, back in 2014, Happer even compared CO2 to Jews in Nazi Germany, saying in an interview, quote, "Demonization of carbon dioxide is just like the demonization of the poor Jews under Hitler." I swear to God, that's what he said. Oh, my God. And a self-described white supremacist Coast Guard officer is arrested for planning a terrorist attack. His plan was to kill prominent Democratic lawmakers, including AOC, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and several high-profile television anchors from MSNBC and CNN. It's all over the news, right? Nonstop coverage. Not quite. And yes, Daryl Metcalf loves his veggies. It's just like, I could listen to that over and over again. I'm telling you. Chris Rabb calls out Tom Wolf for doubling down on natural gas exploitation. Extractivism until we die. And if you want to just one example of why climate change is the real national emergency and why we can't double down on extractivism, as the Wolf administration wants to do, well, there's a new study that was just released showing that in 2017, climate change has cost Annapolis, Maryland, right on the bay, Annapolis, Maryland, nearly 2% of its economic activity, and saw significant flooding of at least 63 floods in 2017 alone. Crazy. And Sean ended up driving through Wednesday's snowstorm to get to an America's Votes conference in D.C. And he'll recap some of the speakers who attended it. Yep, got the wonk out for a couple days. And speaking of walking out, I went to an amazing Labor Notes workshop this past Saturday in Kutztown. Great discussion about building power in the union. And yes, we talked quite a bit about caucuses. Talked quite a bit about Oakland and West Virginia. how you take power. In today's last call, China's moon landing on the dark side may just launch a new space race. And China's future plans include a new space station, new lunar base, and possibly a sample returns from missions from Mars. And China's military space program is, quote, continues to mature rapidly, according to the Department of Defense. Good thing, because that's why, you know, we just had to do it. Trump officially launched the Space Force. That's right. Space Policy Directive 4 calls for a commander of the Space Force who will, quote, lead space warfighting through global space operations that may occur in the space domain, the terrestrial domain, or throughout the electromagnetic spectrum. Dun, dun, dun. And as part of that space race, NASA is planning to put astronauts on the moon in 2028. And that was Trump's Space Policy Directive 1, just in case you're keeping score at home. Space race indeed. Mattel is launching astrophysicist and astronaut Barbie this year. This will continue Barbie's 50-year history of space exploration, actually. And Facebook told me today that 1 year ago, my daughter and I finished the first stage of the 1,969-piece Lego NASA Apollo Saturn V rocket. Pretty cool, right? Still got it together. The thing's awesome. Today is National Margarita Day. And at To Celebrate, Free Will's got a double release for you. Not only do we get the 5th of May, that sour ale aged in tequila barrels with key limes and Himalayan salt, but we also get one of my all-time favorites, Safe Word, an Imperial IPA with mangoes and habanero peppers coming in at 10.4% ABV. Burns so sweet. And Sean, yes, you may have heard, it's making its way across the land. Sean made his legendary return to Pizza Boy. Dun, dun, dun. I want to remind everybody, tune in to the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. You can also stream his show live at freespeech.org. And also tune in on Dish Network, DirecTV, or through the Free Speech TV app on Roku. Make sure you download the Rick Smith Show daily podcast on iTunes, Podbean, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if we want a progressive future, we need progressive media. You can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress today and choose your membership level. If you're not ready to become a member, no problem. Just go to ragingchickenpress.org and click on the big blue donate button on the right sidebar. Best way to invest in keeping the media in the movement in the media, well, that's still to become a member. $5 a month. Go to Raging Chicken Press's Patreon page, patreon.com/rcpress today. And Sean and I actually didn't talk about this in the lead up today, but I would like to welcome Dorcas. Dorcas, I'm gonna butcher her last name today. Olatunji. She's going to correct me on this. We'd like to welcome aboard as a new Raging Chicken writer. She comes out of Newcastle, Delaware, and she's going to be kind of writing some stuff, particular on climate change initially. So look for her stuff. Going to be appearing on the pages of Raging Chicken very soon. Welcome, Dorcas. So, Sean, you made it through the rain. You made it through the snow. All because you ate your veggies.
Yes. All because I ate my veggies.
Unbelievable, man.
I hear if you eat more veggies, it smooths everything out and it makes the bullshit come out a lot easier.
Well, the bullshit is actually compost, you see. It's actually compost, Sean. It's something that kind of comes out kind of really well. And what it does is, like, you know, it keeps your white supremacy going strong, apparently. So there you go. Good old our friend.
Daryl Metcalf.
Never gets
old. I think the best thing about that, like, that whatever, that run-on sentence, mm-hmm. I guess.
Whatever that was.
Whatever it was, like, run-on paragraph. Yeah. I don't know. But, like, he couldn't, like, formulate a full, like, sentence. Like he couldn't string a sentence together. Like if you listen to it, it was just like a bunch of phrases just like thrown together.
Well, it's like the kind of thing where he sat down and he had this great idea and he kind of memorized the speech and then he kind of forgot it. So he just like was like uttering phrases from this speech, right? And, you know, it just, I have to say, what it reminded me a lot of, let me see if I can find it. It reminded me a lot of this. Remember, this is an oldie but goodie in Raging Chicken.
Stop touching me. Stop touching me.
Chairman, you're yelling at a lady. I wish you would.
President Bradford, I'm not yelling at anybody. I'm telling you, you're out of order. Please stop talking into the microphone now so we can receive our testimony. I'm a heterosexual. I have a wife. I love my wife.
Stop touching me. Stop touching me.
Beg. Don't touch. I'm a heterosexual. I have a wife.
Oh, God. I've been, you know, I'm glad I still had that on the soundboard after you sent that out over the name. Because I'm like, you know what? I get, I have volume two now. So with, I like my vegetables.
Popeye over here.
Oh, my God. Or something. Or something. But man, so big news this week, Bernie Sanders is officially making it a go. Yeah. What's your take, man?
I 100% support it. I absolutely love it. I mean, the platform that he put out was pretty much like a standard bearer for the progressive like movement. And it's, I mean, he's going to have like a very loud group of detractors, but I mean, I think he has a good shot at like getting through the primary.
Well, we're going to see. You know, here's the thing, right?
Sanders is already in the process of reshaping Democratic politics as we know it. I mean, like without Sanders, you don't have people like Rashida Tlaib, you don't have AOC, you don't have Ilhan Omar running for office. You don't have these brand of progressives that would have normally ran. Like, yes, Trump got them to run like in the end, but like I think also a lot of them would not have felt empowered to run if it was not for Bernie Sanders and the type of campaign that Sanders ran and like the how they cracked the fundraising.
Yes.
Like the small dollar donations.
Well, it just showed you. I mean, this is something that, you know, I mean, people have been commenting on for a while, and Bernie was very good about developing kind of the organization. And it shows you that that organization, you know, is already at full throttle. You know what I mean? I mean, it doesn't have to take, it's not up, it doesn't need time to get up and running. This is an organization that is efficient. You know, basically he met every single threshold within the first day, right? Yeah. Actually within the first like 8 hours, every threshold of say getting in the debates, for example, that's already done.
And we were talking about this, like about like the building infrastructure, like before the show.
Right.
And I mean, like the people who worked on his campaign in 2016, like didn't go away. Like it's not like campaign staffers who go in back into like consulting and trying to work on the next campaign. No, these people went into the field and they continued the organizing work that they've been doing. Or they ran campaigns like Jess King's campaign with Becca and Nick and John Smucker and all them. Like they all were involved in the Bernie campaign in 2016. Like all, a lot of people from the Bernie 16 campaign continued the organizing work after the primary into 17, into 18. And they've been doing this for almost like 3 years now.
No, that's right. And a lot of the on the ground organizing that's been going on in kind of locales has included those folks who kind of cut their teeth in political work in the Bernie Sanders campaign.
Yeah. Like look at the success that Reclaim Philadelphia has been having, you know, with getting Larry Krasner elected, getting some state reps elected, and now looking to push a really progressive slate into the Philadelphia City Council at open races, a slate of three progressive women, one incumbent with Helen Gim, and two other up-and-coming like women of color. Like, I mean, like this is the organizing work. Like, this is the continuance of the 2016 campaign. And like if they rack up these wins locally, the 2020 campaign is, I think the machine that Sanders has is going to be tremendous.
Yeah. Well, you know,
I don't think the on the ground machine is not going to be matched by anything that anyone else has.
No, we'll see. But you know, again, I think it is going to be a very different kind of campaign. I mean, on the one hand, and I know this is kind of like, you know, this is not saying anything new. This is what a lot of folks have been commenting on. You've got a much wider field. Right. It's not as much as the clear contrast.
right, just between kind of Sanders and Clinton. And you've got a lot of other dynamics that are going that are kind of going on in the campaign. And having said that, right, I say that in part because I think it's important for kind of people in movements, right, to keep our kind of eyes on the prize here, right, and kind of understand that this cannot be simply about, say, just personalities. I mean, a lot of the folks that are committed to, you know, the kind of platform that Bernie Sanders has run on, right, kind of get that. But there's also kind of big segments, right, of our country, right, that are it's all about personality. Right. It's all about the, you know, the messiah figure that could come on and kind of save things. And, you know, and Sanders has always kind of pushed back on that idea that it's just him. He's going to come in and do this. He's always says we have to do this together. There has to be the political revolution. But, you know, I saw this this article in this the most recent Jacobin and by Megan Day. Right. And she's actually kind of looking at what could happen, right? You know, because there's a lot of talk in the talk shows about, you know, if Sanders comes in, he's still not going to be able to enact this stuff because you have a Congress that is not necessarily supportive. And so she's talking about the different things that he could do with executive orders, right? Everything from, you know, student loan.
Declaring a national emergency and implementing the Green New Deal, wiping out the student debt, Medicare for all.
Right, kind of like all sorts of stuff on kind of
packing the Supreme Court,
foreign policy, kind of on criminal justice and things like this. And while I appreciate the like what Megan Day is trying to say here, right? The idea that there's a lot that can happen, that the president matters, right, and has kind of real authority to do things that could be really significant, even in the absence of Congress. At the same time, I'm also really like it makes me really nervous to think about imperial presidencies, right, where it's about, you know, kind of enacting things from the top. And so that I think is that's always got to be a kind of front and center here, that no matter which candidate makes it through the Democratic primary, it's going to be up to all of us. Right. Whether it's like, you know, well, yeah, the organizing of all of us to hold anybody accountable and to build that power. So that's the thing that's constantly sticking in my mind. So, you know, I'm looking, I think that Bernie Sanders being in the campaign right now and being on that debate stage, the one thing that it does, it's kind of like the, you know, he's got the it's the barometer, so to speak, of the particular policy prescriptions that all these kind of Democrats are kind of railing around. Right. So now when you've got Bernie Sanders in the campaign and the question is about Medicare for all, he's not going to allow the kind of slipperiness of saying like access to medical care for everyone, which means like, you know,
means testing medic
give backs to the private insurance companies so that they'll be good to us and extend their insurance to us. No, he's going to say he's going to lay down the you know, the gauntlet on Medicare for all. It's not going to be like debt free college. No, it's going to be free college, public college tuition. Right. Yeah. Tuition free college, not debt free stuff in some sort of schemes that you're working with the bankers. Right. I mean, every step of the way, I think he's going to be an important force in forcing real policy discussions on that stage. And he's going to define kind of the left end of what it means to be progressive on that stage.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I mean, I think it's going to be an interesting really, really interesting campaign.
Yeah.
So what's the news? How is that playing itself out in the Twitter sphere these days?
What, the Bernie
Sanders announcement? Yeah, I'm just curious.
I have not been plugged into it, but you know, a lot of the same ad hominems about like the Bernie Bros and stuff like that, and how it's just a bunch of like you know, well-to-do white people supporting Bernie Sanders and stuff like that. Which I think is just all total bullshit. And it's like, I do get that there is an issue with a very loud minority of like Sanders supporters, like those Bernie bro types.
Yeah.
But like, that's not the whole entire campaign. You know, like these people are being singled out to project on all of the Sanders supporters. And I just think that's very short-sighted.
Yeah, and we'll see. There's actually there's also an interesting piece in The Intercept by Mendy Hassan. Right, it's called "Critics Say Bernie Sanders is Too Old, Too White, and Too Socialist to Run for President in 2020." They're wrong, and here's why. It's kind of an interesting, kind of more a little bit more on the wonky side, right? Kind of looking at polls, looking at the background. It's not kind of a more. It's not as much as an ideological piece, although there's some discussion there about the way that the party has moved. So we'll see. I mean, because I do think that, you know, I do think that, say, gender and race is going to be kind of a really important part of this election, especially given what the Trump administration has wrought.
Yeah. And I think Sanders has made the right moves already to with the people he's staffing his campaign with. Nina Turner's making a comeback. The person who was the policy director at the ACLU is going to be running the campaign. Supposed to be one of the smartest Democratic operatives in the field that's out there. And then, no, I mean the top. This whole entire campaign is going to be a diverse campaign. Mm-hmm. And I mean, when your campaign's going to be diverse, when you campaign on the issues of Medicare for All, when you campaign on ending, you know, poverty wages and stuff like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm excited. I mean, I was excited before Sanders kind of came in. Now I'm even more excited. I mean, obviously in terms of policy stuff, right. In terms of like, you know, I mean, he ticks pretty much all the boxes that are kind of like critical for me. And what we've talked about is kind of like, you know, there should be, you know, here's the litmus test, right? You know, the litmus test of this has got to be Medicare for All, free college tuition, Green New Deal. What was the other one? I'm missing one here. Free college. I'm just spacing it right now. But, you know, the idea that, you know, This stuff is real, and we're going to accomplish this. So we're going to see. I think this is going to kick everything into high gear. I mean, MSNBC has been, you know, kind of like plugging its first debate that they're going to be having. It's going to be in June, I guess, and it's going to be in two heats, so to speak. Right? They're going to solve the kind of too many people on the stage problem by having two consecutive nights of random drawings of, you know, for two nights of debate. And frankly, I think that's a good move on the part of the party, because basically what it does is it has more exposure to the ideas, right? Which is critical.
Yeah. And I mean, this is the primary we should have had in 2016.
Yeah. That's a great point. That's a great point. So meanwhile, so you've got Bernie at the top, you got to hear, you definitely have got, teachers, from the bottom up, West Virginia, Oakland, right? And Denver, right? I mean, kind of 2 weeks ago, we're seeing just these kind of rolling, these kind of like rolling strikes and protests in places that we'd not necessarily expect. And it's not just about wages and benefits. This is about kind of like building movements.
Yeah. And I mean, the thing about the West Virginia teacher strike that was so big was it was a like political strike. This wasn't like over like wages or anything like that. This was over charter school policy. Like they stopped like a charter school bill from in its tracks.
Right.
Yeah. Like this is that's one of the big things I wanted to highlight with the West Virginia teachers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Their latest walkout. I mean, that shows you a lot more power than like fighting for wages too.
Right. There's this really cool article, I think, that's worth a read. It's a kind of quick read for folks. It's called "What's Behind the Teacher Strikes? Unions Focus on Social Justice, Not Just Salaries." It's by Rebecca Tarlau, T-A-R-L-A-U. She's Assistant Professor of Education and Labor and Employment Relations at Penn State. And she basically points to the fact that, you know, these strikes are being driven by three factors. And that's one, the acceleration of market-based education reforms like the expansion of charter schools. That's huge in the West Virginia issue, right? Because there was in the education reform bill that they stopped, right? That was kind of one of the key issues that they struck over, was that they were going to introduce the kind of charterization and the privatization of public schools in the state. And they were like having, you know, not having it at all. The second thing is the networks of teacher activists organizing and transforming their unions to focus on broader social issues. And this is why I think this is really worth a read, because later in this article, what Tarlo does is she kind of shows that how in each one of these cases, and Sean and I have talked about this before, in the case of Chicago, in the case of West Virginia, in the case of even what's going on in Philly, is that this kind of militant action is always preceded by years of organizing the establishment of progressive caucuses within the unions, right? They're basically, you know, who eventually kind of build power by building networks with the community, by building relations with the community, by building member-driven organizing and member-driven kind of activism, and then eventually running slates of candidates to kind of take over the leadership of their union and to turn it into a more militant body. What's really interesting about the Oakland case, right, those teachers just went on strike on Thursday. The leaders of that strike, right, to give you a sense of the trajectory here, and this is going to echo things that if Sean has said 1,000 times over, but they say that they got their inspiration to start the caucus in during Occupy, right? There was an attempt to kind of, I think it was shut down a local school or charterize it or something like this at one point, and Occupy, the folks that were active in Occupy, did an Occupy, like an occupation of the school, right? Occupy Education in Oakland, and a lot of those teachers and the community members joined it to kind of save this school. And that caucus kind of has drawn from that engagement that those teachers had with Occupy at the time. So again, we see these kind of cycles of struggle, right? We see that from 2011, right, up until now, right? So that is a pretty quick turnaround when you're talking about massive organizations to move from relatively complacent business unionism, where, you know, the leaders of the union think that, okay, everything's going to happen behind closed doors and everything depends on their personal relationship with people in power on the other side, versus power that begins and ends with kind of rank and file members taking control of their unions. So that is really kind of important. And the third factor that Tarlo says is about the framing of teacher union action as part of the struggle for racial justice, right? Of how teachers have been front and center for this. What's interesting too as well, she said, look, this was not always the case, is that teachers were not always kind of out in the front historically, right? But now teachers have basically have been front and center on labor activism across the country right now. Right. They have let there's been more work stoppages now since like 1986 or something. There's been more work stoppages primarily by teachers than there has been any time since about 1986, sometime during the Reagan administration. So, I mean, there's a lot to be happy about here.
The largest walkout or like labor action last year was a teacher strike. It was one of the largest action in years, and it was the Arizona teacher strike that happened. It was one of the largest mass like strikes that happened in the past like 10 or 15 years, I think.
There you go, man. So
it was definitely the largest for last year, that's for sure.
Yeah, cool. And we're going to talk a little bit more about caucuses in our second segment today, because I was at the Labor Notes conference. We talked a lot about this stuff, and it's going to be important kind of moving forward. But it's holy cow. I think all of us have a lot to learn from these teachers, it's a good thing that they're teaching us more broadly, not just in their classrooms, but like how to do this kind of activism. It's pretty amazing. So, down in North Carolina, yep, a new vote is going to be called for the congressional race after there's been fraud down there. I've been following this a little bit, but you've been kind of paying a little bit more attention to this, I think, than I have.
Somewhat, yes. The candidate involved, the Republican candidate, like I've been watching it from a distance, but I was reading something the other day that the candidate here, Mark Harris, his son warned him in 2016 not to hire the campaign operative that he hired, ended up eventually hiring because of alleged voter fraud issues with mail-in ballots. And Mark Harris's son is like a federal attorney, and he was deposed on Monday. He had to speak on the record about this, and his son had to tell like the people like at this hearing, whoever is involved with this hearing, that yes, he warned his dad not to hire this person and cited the same concerns, and his dad turns around and fucking hires the same guy.
There you go.
Nothing like taking advice from your kid.
No, nothing. And the testimony that I have seen in this case has been like,
it's just bad.
It's just, I mean, there's no way that this guy is kind of getting out of it. And so, and you know, he basically says he's not going to run now. So, and it's going to be, so the, you know, this is, actually,
how could you run after this?
Well, look at our political context right now, though. You know what I mean? I mean, okay, you've
yeah.
got.
No, yeah, I know.
I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean, you show me what's not. You show me what's affirmed.
No, like, this guy could run. I was like, yeah, you know what? Fuck it. I'll do it. I'll double down.
Exactly.
I'll do more voter suppression the next time around. And I'm going to be your congressman for life.
Right. Exactly. Right. I mean, until.
And there's nothing you could fucking do about it.
Yeah. See, this is kind of like what. This is what I mean is like, well, I didn't necessarily think because I there was some reporting earlier on, you know, people say, well, he's got to step down. I'm like, really? He's got to step down? Really? Just like what? Trump has got to show his taxes. I mean, you know, I mean, like this whole idea about this appeal to norms.
Or that Kavanaugh has to step down over rape allegations.
Right. Exactly. Or that kind of like Virginia needs a new government right? because they're still doubling down. You know what I'm saying? It's like. I don't – when people say this should – there's no way that this could happen, unless there's some sort of like precedent or kind of legal statute for this to go on, we're watching all these norms just kind of being blown up. So when this guy actually stepped down, right, which leads me actually to believe this. It was like when this guy basically said he's not going to run, that leads me to believe that there was a whole big kind of shit pile of stuff in addition to this that would have come out had that had he fought it.
Yeah,
but
and he probably still would have won.
Well, who knows? Who knows? Who knows? It was a pretty close race. That's the thing.
Yeah.
So, we'll see. We'll see. I'm not even going to get into what's going on in the Mueller probe. I don't know if you got anything you want to say about it, but
I want the fucking P tapes.
Wants the P tapes.
I've said this before, and I'll say it again. Where's the motherfucking P tapes at?
Oh my god.
That's all I gotta say.
Oh my god. No, but really, is like, you know, you're watching this little nice cycle of reporting because you got, again, you got new attorney general. You know, again, I'm this is well worn path at this point, right?
But like, I will say this.
Yeah.
The Manhattan district attorney is going to be filing charges against Mueller, or not Mueller, against Manafort, which will shield Manafort from any pardon from the Trump administration if he gets convicted on in New York. New York State,
because it's not a federal, it's not a federal thing. Yep.
So local DAs are now going to be getting involved with this. So I would not be surprised if you see more of this stuff happening too.
Look, I don't think
on the state levels.
Well, I'm of the opinion of this too as well. I almost think that Trump is completely okay with allowing Manafort and whoever else is there to sit in jail for a little bit before he gives a pardon. He wants to make sure that these people shut up until he's clear.
Yeah.
Right? So then if they want the pardon, you know, because look, if they get a pardon, they can go say whatever the hell they want. Right? They could write a book, right, and expose all this stuff. I mean, that's the way I think Trump thinks. And so, you know, Manafort may be angling for a pardon, but, you know, it's like until, like, Trump is clear, it's not going to impact him, then I don't think that's ever going to happen. We'll see if that plays itself out.
Yeah,
but the crazy thing. So there's all that stuff. There's all the stuff that's going on with, you know, the debate over nuclear tech, which, you know, this came out this week too as well. That Trump officials, there's pretty much of a bombshell report that Trump officials have basically been trying to, like, you know, trying to sell nuclear tech to Saudi Arabia, like in violation of all sorts of like international laws and all sorts of things like this. They're trying to say,
I would get a tower.
Exactly. I like the sound of it. I like the sound of Saudi Arabia. I mean, don't you remember, you guys? They let me touch their orb.
Trump Arabia.
Yeah, Trump Arabia. I can see it now. It'd be beautiful. It'd be terrific. It'd be wonderful. So crazy. The one thing to keep an eye on is this. Is this ridiculous move, right, on the part of the administration to have a committee on climate security? So you remember one of the organizations in the government that has been kind of sounding the alarm bells on climate change for a long time has been the Pentagon, right? They've been consistently said that this is going to be one of the emerging kind of serious security threats to the nation.
Yeah, it's going to cause famine, war.
Exactly.
pestilence.
Exactly. Access to water is going to create all sorts of civil war. I mean, all bunch of stuff like this. Right. Yeah. And so,
I mean, and we also have our empire built up to a point where,
right,
once these conflicts start happening in other parts of the world, our empire will step in and squash them and get people back in line.
Right. Right. But, you know, Trump doesn't want to hear any of this stuff, and neither do his people. So they're just going to get a commission. It's going to, you know, with this guy, Happer, who comes on, who's a climate denier, who thinks that CO2 is nothing but a good thing, much like our good friend
Daryl Metcalf.
I'm sure Happer eats his veggies, too. But, you know, they're just going to try to put together this insane report that's going to say that, you know, climate change is not a problem, that the Pentagon is wrong. And so, you know, this is just going to be one of these tools that they're going to use for political showmanship, to try to go after the Green New Deal, to go after any kind of positive kind of developments on climate change resistance. So we'll see. You got a big smile on your face, Sean.
Yeah, it's good. It's Metcalf related.
You want to save that for a second segment?
Yeah, no. Yeah. One of my friends who's a writer just saw the Metcalf video. And just like Metcalf !!
Oh, awesome. And last but not least, yes, once again, we see another white supremacist.
Shocking.
Another shocking. Yep. Again,
this breaking time, news. Stop the presses.
Yep. This time, a lieutenant with the Coast Guard.
Shocking that they're actually in service, too.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. And he had spent the last several years accumulating a stockpile of weapons. According to federal prosecutors, had produced some of the most detailed plans for mass killing that the country has seen in memory. So literally had detailed plans on how to go after Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, about Nancy Pelosi, Rachel Maddow, a whole bunch of Jim Acosta on the CNN, and was planning on doing this. And obviously, you know, there were mental health issues here, but all this stuff has been fostered by, you know, white nationalist ideology and an administration in the White House that is just kind of fanning the flames of this kind of garbage.
So, yeah, it's all that needs to be said.
Yep, exactly. The one thing I'll say, too, as well, is that I don't know if you saw the reporting about people saying that AOC has got some luxury high-rise building, like apartment. Did you see this thing?
No, I did not.
Well, so there was some reporting. I think I don't know if it was like Fox News or whatever. It was like one of these right-wing things come out, and they start kind of saying, oh, yeah, she says she's like all – you know this line of argument. Like,
yes.
She says she's like working class, but now she's got a luxury high-rise apartment in D.C. and blah, 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 right? And they – basically release where she lives, right? Mm-hmm. And that's happening as this dude is freaking planning to kill people, right? Now, I want to be clear. I'm not saying that this was...
It's par for the course.
Right. And she came out right away, right? Right away with like, kind of like, on the one hand, whatever, people. Right? I'm not even going to kind of go back and forth. But this is not a game, right? You start disclosing where people live and these nut jobs are going to come after you. Right. And it just go back and forth. But I mean, it could be potentially seriously dangerous, especially when you've got this rhetoric of these, you know, these radical socialists are coming to take, you know, to take your kids off to the gulag and crap like that. Not good.
Yeah.
So crazy, crazy. Anything else you kind of noticed this past week in national politics?
No, nothing really.
Yeah, it was a kind of a – it was actually a whole lot went on, and there's a whole lot of stuff that is really – it's just kind of in process, is why I didn't want to get in the Mueller probes stuff. It's like, look, that stuff is going to come out. We'll see if the reporting that it's coming to a close is true or not. And there's going to be a whole bunch of stuff that's going to play itself out that we're just going to kind of leave there for now, because right now it feels like there's a whole lot of people reporting on developments in this investigation that it's just about people spinning their wheels and conjecture. So we're going to leave it there. All right, so this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. When we come back, we're going to get into some more of the PA focus. I want to remind you, the best way that you can support this podcast, that you can support our writing, right, and bringing on new writers like Dorcas, like I talked about in the on the opening segment, too, where she's going to be doing some climate reporting. She's coming on and basically expanding the progressive voice that we have here at Raging Chicken Press. We can't do that without your help. So become a member of Raging Chicken Press. Simply go to patreon.com/RC Press today. We'll be right back with PA Focus.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 2004. That was the day Secretary of Education Rod Page stated that he considered the National Education Association to be a terrorist organization. He made the remarks during a meeting with governors who were visiting the White House. His apology a few hours later was just as inflammatory. There he expressed his frustration at the, quote, obstructionist scare tactics the NEA's Washington lobbyists have employed against No Child Left Behind's historic reforms. Representing almost 3 million educators, the NEA had been fighting many aspects of the No Child Left Behind Act passed by Congress in 2001. The teachers' unions had initially supported the measure, but they came to realize that the act was designed to undermine public education in favor of charter, private, and religious schools. No Child Left Behind mandated regular standardized testing of students. It also threatened financial penalties and school closures. Governors on board with the goals of the act soon grew frustrated. The Bush administration reneged on federal funding necessary for its implementation. The union movement was outraged at Page's smear. John Sweeney, then president of the AFL-CIO, said, quote, the Bush administration would like to label all those who disagree with it as terrorists in order to cover up its policies, which are harmful to working families and to divert attention from its inability to create good jobs. By 2015, the No Child Left Behind Act had received so much criticism from every corner that the Every Student Succeeds Act replaced it. This act retains Common Core standards but transfers school accountability to the states. It is now pending review under President Donald Trump's Regulatory Freeze Directive. In 2017, it was pending review under President Donald Trump's Regulatory Freeze Directive.
Daryl Metcalf.
Yes, once again, Daryl loves his veggies. Sean, take it away.
I think we need to play the clip again.
Oh, you want to play the clip again? Let me see if I can pull it up because I've got it in it's not easy to pull it up. Well, here we'll go talk over the beginning of it. We're going to play this. This is our intro. I'm going to have to play through the intro just so you can hear it. Hope you don't mind that, everybody. So let me see if I can pull this down a little bit so we can talk over it. And then here you go. Ready?
Just to be on record, I enjoy my vegetables, and plants need CO2. So I want to make sure we still have plenty of CO2 out there so we have green grass and green vegetables growing, because we need CO2. We can't eliminate all CO2. So I think we're going to have an interesting debate for those that want to produce something that's actually needed by our environment, claiming that they're improving the environment.
Well, there it is. And I swear, that is not edited. That is exactly as he said it, right? We're going to have a link in the show notes directly to the video so you can see it for yourselves. That was the I don't know, Shakespeare himself, I guess. Unbelievable.
Oh boy. I guess where should we unpack with this? Like,
I don't even know. I mean, I mean,
there's just so many brain cells that were killed listening to that.
It really is remarkable, right? I mean, it really is remarkable.
Like, there is no shortage on stupid in the Capitol.
Yeah.
I mean, if like there was a shortage on stupid, I don't know how I would be like making money at this point. Like, like it is. It's amazing how, like, okay, so Metcalf, as everyone knows, wanted to get the House Judiciary Committee, didn't, got dumped onto Department of Environmental and Energy Resources Committee, and absolutely hates being on this committee, and has, like, really has, like, no skin in the game yet. And I guess because he can't, like, really hurt – black and brown people.
Yeah, I think that's
and marginalized communities, like as he could with state government committee, or how he could with like the judiciary committee.
Right.
But I mean, like maybe this is like the beginning of the end for Metcalf.
Yeah, I mean,
he's just going to be languishing in irrelevance for the next couple of years and just saying stupid shit like this. And he's just going to be looked at as the joke that he is because he knows nothing about the environment. He knows nothing about science. And, like, he held state government because he's a fascist and he wanted to put the screws to people in marginalized communities by banning legislation or, you know, by blocking stuff, meaningful legislation in the House State Government Committee. And now he's just going to be here in the Environmental Committee and he's just going to be useless and just bathing in his own irrelevance at this point.
Well, and here it is too, as well. Like that, like we should say too, as well. I didn't say this before, but that clip is actually from his webpage.
Yeah.
That's his YouTube channel. Right. So that wasn't somebody kind of like, he posted it, and the clip that I played is actually at the beginning of the clip. It's not like buried deep in something. That's the very start of the clip, and
yeah,
the title
so
of
like
it.
The
wait,
first
wait,
30 seconds.
Yeah, the title of it is Representative Metcalf refutes CO2 agenda. That was his refutation. He eats his vegetables. Holy crap!
And like he said, Mr. Sunday, the person he's talking to is a natural gas lobbyist in the state. So he's speaking in front of a committee that is just testifying. People are testifying and it's just completely stacked in favor of the oil and gas industry. And like, this is his like that him trying to like say, I love you guys. I love CO2 and greenhouse gases because I want to eat my veggies.
Yeah, he's like looking at him. He's like, because like, you know, vegetables, like they need CO2. And he's like, look at him kind of like, am I right? Right, guys? Right? I mean, come on. You're with me on this vegetable thing, right?
Yeah.
Because you know what? All those lefties, Sean, they like vegetables. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to pull a Bill Clinton triangulation here and I'm going to take
boy.
Vegetables away from them.
Like, soy boy, Darryl Metcalf.
It's like, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, what the hell? Oh my gosh, Darryl Metcalf. But you know, here's the thing: it's like
he's doing it in the defense of climate denial,
right? So. Exactly, and that's like, you know, and again, here's the danger of him being on them. I mean, as a freaking idiot white supremacist, like, you know, who just wants to harm everybody, being kind of ahead of that committee is like, you know, on the one hand, we could say that the state Republicans did not give him his choice committee on the state government or on judiciary. Right. And they stuck him here. But this is going to do real damage.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, because it's just like anything that is potentially possible is just going to be shut down. Yep.
Yeah,
exactly. So,
and that's why he wasn't put on Judiciary Committee.
Right. Right. But just we always just have to remember that, you know, the PA Republicans, what they could have done is said, nah, you're done. You don't get the head of any committee, Daryl. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, they give him a committee, but it's like consumer affairs or something like that. Like some bullshit committee.
Just to be on record.
Sorry. Still sick from last week a little bit.
Yeah. Everybody, can you say it with me? Oh, poor Sean.
I know. Well, no, I'm just saying mind my coughing.
Yeah, yeah, no, I know. I'm just giving you a hard time.
Yeah, I know.
Surprise, surprise. Oh, man. So good old Daryl. Good old Daryl. What else can we say? But meanwhile, Daryl Metcalf is not the only one that seems to be engaged with the climate discussions of late.
Yeah, Chris Rapp put a pretty charged tweet out there this morning. You know, there was a pipeline explosion that happened that killed a little, like, 12-year-old girl. You know, power that was distributing energy for natural gas going to her home exploded. She posted a video, and literally the video ended in a ball of fire.
Yep.
And the screen goes blank. Berks Gas Troop tweets it out, and Chris Rabb then tweets it out, retweets it, and says, pulling it up real quick, natural gas is neither clean nor safe, if the means by which it is extracted and distributed aren't. We are putting actual people at risk by doubling down on natural gas versus committing to a just transition to 100 by 50, 100% renewable by 2050.
Yep.
No, I mean, he's absolutely correct.
Yep. Yep. I don't know what to say. I mean, this is kind of something we've been saying, that this has been one of the
administration. You know, he's talking about the Wolf administration doubling down.
Yep.
Like when he says we, it means Governor Wolf. And we have decided to make our bed with natural gas industry, using dirty energy. And like, you know, like we're like having an extraction tax to contribute to building the infrastructure, to building out more more natural gas well pads and pipelines and stuff across the state. So like we are fully committing ourselves to, you know, pillaging any part of the environment we have left in Pennsylvania and causing more pollution of the water sources and, you know, having more fugitive methane escapes. And that all becomes greenhouse gas emissions. And we, you know, instead of talking about the Green New Deal, we want to stick with just some of the worst extractivism possible. Yep. As state policy. I don't know what else there's left to say besides that.
Well, the only thing I'll add to this is like, here's here's one of the things that's pretty crazy. There was like this past week, I guess PA lawmakers introduced this bipartisan kind of like bill on community solar power, and it gets like it's the kind of bill that I absolutely hate, right? Because it's basically like this, because it's like seven steps removed from what's
reality.
Not reality, but let's put it this way: if you want to have a major impact on solar, right? You have a direct subsidy for solar, right? For solar panels, and you distribute that in the network. Period. Right. In this way, it's kind of like this quasi market thing where, you know, so say, for example, you live in a cloudier part of the state or in a place that's not rated like with a high solar potential of like where your house is. Right. But somebody else in a different part of the state, right, is in a very sunny area and they're actually selling power back to that you can actually, the shady person can buy into that person's kind of it's like this freaking crazy market mechanism. Right. As opposed to saying, no, we need to do this as a state. Right. It still is relying upon individual homeowners to kind of make this choice. And again, I don't have any problem with there being incentives for individual homeowners to put solar panels on their house. The other thing about it, what's troubling to me about the fact that doubling down on extractivism in this state is that Pennsylvania actually saw jobs increase in solar. Right. And nationally, those jobs in solar have been declining. Right. In Pennsylvania, they're actually going up. I mean, it's not like rocket through the roof. So the messaging here, right, what could have happened was that the Democratic Party, right, and Tom Wolf at the front of it said, like, in Pennsylvania, right, we are going to prove that this state can lead the charge in solar panels. We're already seeing an increase on here. And what we're going to do is we're going to support the efforts of all those individual homeowners who are already doing this kind of investing. Right. Without the kind of support that we should be giving them. Right. They could actually build upon that. Like, and you're seeing right here that there's jobs in this area, but instead of putting them in a cracker plant, instead of putting them in kind of pipeline construction, they should be putting them in kind of building solar and wind, period.
And one of the things that was really big this week here in Harrisburg, governor had a press conference on it, and then labor industry had a committee hearing on it, was workforce development. A lot of people are aging out of their jobs, and millennial, like younger people just aren't like going into those trades.
Right.
Because of, you know, our continual attacks on public education, destroying shop, forcing kids to go to college instead of going into building trades because we've made them a non-desirable living. To like we stigmatized that type of living, you know, like, you know, being a blue collar worker, you know, by forcing everyone to go to college. Yep. And now we have a shortage of building trades and, you know, people who can actually build out this infrastructure.
Yep.
And this is what these jobs programs are about. These jobs programs are about building, you know, helping building out the cities that need the help, but also building out the natural gas infrastructure that, you know, no one's going into.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And you can think about what we could do. Like, you know, what's interesting, like IBEW, right? My brother's is a member of IBEW. And one of the things that IBEW started doing, right, several years ago, is they started basically doing, because this is what, you know, the trade unions could do, right? They started training their workers in the kind of like in solar installation and kind of like kind of wiring and all this kind of stuff that was like preparing for this kind of energy transition, right? Because if you think about it, like electricians, right, are really important in that whole whole business. Whether you're talking about your, you know, personal wiring kind of going in your house, or you're talking about kind of power distribution networks and power lines and things like this. So that's the kind of investment that it's going to take, right? And to see that those jobs could actually be like beneficial. What it's actually going to take at this point, because politicians, just exactly as you're saying, politicians and so much in our culture has just been invested, like I said, college for everybody, right? And take on the debt and do all that stuff, to basically say, no, we want to highlight these other jobs too as well. Right? We can highlight these other jobs that, one, they're union jobs. Number two, instead of paying and going into debt to learn a trade, you're actually going to get paid to learn a trade by going through the kind of the union apprenticeship programs. Right. And you're going to actually put the workers where they need to be. Right. Because if you look at any kind of a building out infrastructure, whether you're talking about high speed Internet, whether you're talking about distributive networks for solar and wind. Right. That is all a massive infrastructure project, which could be all about kind of creating jobs that are going to be sustainable for like decades to come, as opposed to kind of knock out a pipeline that's going to be finished construction in like a couple of years. And is going to be kind of like, as we saw what Chris Rabb was drawing attention to, extraordinarily dangerous. And kind of like, you know, by, you know, contributing to the demise of our planet. Right. So, man, it's just it's continually disappointing. Let's just put it that way.
Yes.
So crazy. So on the flip side of disappointing, though, I think you and I both actually had a kind of pretty good experience the past several days in terms of different conferences and that kind of stuff. And you were down in D.C., right?
Yes. I had to drive through the snowstorm on Wednesday to get to D.C.
By the way, we all hate you for that, Sean, because as you said on Twitter, every time you go someplace that you're traveling, it snows. So therefore, we know now that you are the link. And you're the reason why we all had to deal with that. So just saying.
So I had to,
correlation is not causation. Is that what you're trying to tell me?
Yeah.
Anyways, go ahead.
I had to drive through a storm a couple weeks ago.
A couple days ago. Yeah.
Get to the Keystone Progress Summit out in Pittsburgh. And that was like a really white knuckled trip. And par for the course, I had to drive to D.C. the other day. And I literally drove through the bullseye of this like massive winter storm to get to D.C. to go to an American Votes conference. And that was like my first like actual professional conference, which was pretty pretty interesting.
That was the first one you ever been to?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Cool. Did you completely wonk it up?
No.
No.
I dressed as I normally do. Jeans and a band hoodie, or jeans and a sweater.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Well, before we get into what kind of cool takeaways from the conference, do you have any travel plans coming up? I mean, the rest of us just kind of want to know.
I do not. I'm good for the next few weeks.
All right, just making sure, because I want to know if I need, which days are going to need off, my kids getting school off, stuff like that. Okay. Mm-hmm. So what was the conference like? Any kind of cool stuff?
It was pretty cool, like listening to more like the Wonka stuff, behind the scenes stuff. I got to listen to Kate Brown, or Pam, I think Kate Brown speak from Oregon, the Oregon governor. Mm-hmm. She spoke on like automatic voter registration and a lot of voter issues. There was lunch discussions around gerrymandering and issues like that and how it affects race and poverty. And then in the morning, the person who wrote Winner Takes All spoke, which was awesome. It was pretty good.
Jiranardas. I was going to butcher his last name. That book, like as we've talked about before, is phenomenal, and I'm extraordinarily jealous. When I told my wife actually that you got to see him speak, she was like, "No, was he awesome? Was he awesome?
Dude, she like, I didn't realize like who he was. Like I know his face.
Yeah.
I didn't realize he was the author of that book.
Yep.
And when I saw him like walking like around the front of the reception room, I was like, okay, I know who this person is. And this is going to be ballin'. Like, this is just going to be a great, like, way to start the morning session.
Yeah.
At, like, 9 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, but my wife calls him the, he's the progressive heat miser. Because he's got that silver hair that's kind of, like, yeah. You know, swept up. Yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't realize he worked for McKinsey.
Yeah.
Not anything really here. And, like, McKinsey's, like, a straight-up cult.
Yep.
And I never, apparently the book talks about that, but I mean, not just like, you know, following Mango's campaign and everything like that. You could definitely see why this person just said, fuck it, and became a class traitor, essentially.
Yeah, he's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And I'll say, too, as well, I mean, I've said this before on this show, is that if, you know, right now the state system of higher education is going through a kind of a major change, and the guy who's ahead of it, Daniel Greenstein comes out of the Silicon Valley, comes out of the Gates Foundation, working education policy, and basically what Anand Jirnandas, I'm getting his name wrong again, but basically what he does in Winners Take All is basically he just lays out the logic by which these people work. And I say, you know, anybody who's kind of wants to know what's going to be happening in the state system of higher education and other things that are touched by these people, read this damn book, because it's really, really important.
So. Yep. So and then Stacey Abrams was supposed to speak there. She did not, unfortunately, because the weather. That was really bummed out. Nakima Williams spoke on her behalf, accepted the award. And then Stacey did a thing, like a live, spoke at a live feed afterwards.
Oh, cool. She did come in via live feed.
She did, yes. And that was really cool. And like the next day I was talking to a woman from a group called Black Voters Matter who was doing work down in Georgia. And, you know, we struck up a conversation because she worked on the Abrams campaign. She's like, yeah, I'm still not over it. But I was like, you know what? Like, people are calling for her to run for president, and I think that's just foolish. And she was like, well, how so? And I was like, you know, the network that she's going to be setting up, you know, to overturn, like, the voter disenfranchisement system that basically got Kemp to win, right? Mm-hmm. Was that who it was, Kemp or... Either or, the governor to win. And, like, you know, she has and she's like, no, 100% agree. Like, Stacey Abrams has such a huge megaphone now. As she has a larger megaphone as a private citizen than she would do as a governor or running for higher office. And that her speech from the onset has specifically kneecapped the current administration, because they will always be cloaked as you stole this election.
Yeah.
And they will never be taken as a legitimate policy making body or a policy making administration, or like, and so, you know, like, yeah, it sucks that she lost, but you know what? I have a feeling she's going to do a lot more good now that she's a private citizen too.
Oh, I have no doubt about it. I mean, she's going nowhere. You know what I mean? In terms of, like, you know, it's like she's not going to like disappear from politics. I mean, if anything, she's going to be. I mean, she's been doing what she has been doing, is kind of building power, especially around kind of right to vote, kind of organizing across the state. I mean,
and she came up through the America Votes Network, which I did not know.
Oh, is that true? I didn't know that.
Yes, she was really influential on that.
Very cool. She's. I mean, yeah, Stacey Abrams is awesome. Is awesome.
It was really good. It was a fun conference.
Yeah. So what are you saying? So basically what you're saying is like Bernie Sanders VP pick, Stacey Abrams. Is that what you're saying?
No.
Just saying.
As I would say, there's a much more compelling argument for her to stay where she's at, because the chains that she can have in her community.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, Georgia is – I mean, the thing is, like, I think – yeah, I mean, she is an absolute force, and Georgia is on the cusp of –
becoming a permanent Democratic state.
Exactly, and it's right there.
And
it's all about the, it's all about that infrastructure that – really, Stacey Abrams has been instrumental in kind of building.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so we'll see. So, anything else? Any cool takeaways from that?
A lot of it was, like, wonky stuff, building, you know, infrastructure on the state levels and stuff like that. So it was pretty good. I mean, it was just interesting seeing that for, like, the first time.
Yeah. Well, I was envious that you were in D.C. I love D.C. I miss D.C. what are you going to do? You even got to take my my red line, right?
Yes.
Yeah, the red line in. Yes.
Brought in from Rockville.
Right in for Rockville, yeah. Sean and I were consulting with maps last week. It was the best way down. And, of course, he ends up going right through the freaking center of the snowstorm.
I think, worst of all, I drove on 15.
Oh, you did end up taking 15.
Yeah, I took 15 down.
Oh.
And that was just like...
I don't know. I think 81 might have been worse.
Because of the truck traffic.
Well, yeah. And you're actually going through a lot of kind of hilly kind of terrain.
I was using the Waze app, and I'm never going to use Waze again because of this. It took me off the fucking highway in the middle of, like, Maryland, like 20 miles outside of Frederick because there was a slowdown on 270. Uh-huh. And it took me through, like, a bunch of, like, back country roads that were not treated. And...
This is the first time you're telling me this part.
Yes. So, like, I'm on this, like, 5-mile, like, loop just going out, and it just dumps you off into, like, a 6-lane boulevard that was just never, like, touched by a plow. And I'm just like, oh, dear God, this is where it ends. Like, this is how... And then, like, you turn on the road, and it goes from, like, the 6-lane road into, like, a 2-lane country back road, like a scenic tour, like the scenic loop in this area. And yeah, like, it was like pure whiteout conditions. And these are like hills like this that have, like, a nice, like, curve to them. And it's like, I can't hit my brakes, and I'm going too fast. So I had to, like, drop my car down into, like, gear, like, drop it down into 2 or 1. So I'm, like, using a mechanical brake instead of, like, slamming on my tires and spinning out and ending up in a cornfield.
Right.
So.
Crazy.
It was not a fun drive. It was white knuckle driving for 5 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. Crazy. Well, I last weekend I got to go. This is I mentioned this on last week's podcast, but I got to go to a workshop in Kutztown that Mike Gambone was in part instrumental in kind of organizing, and it was a workshop. It was brought in by it was a Labor Notes workshop for those of you who know the organization. But they've got this amazing book called Secrets for a Successful Organizer. And really was kind of working through some of the practical aspects of building power and organizing, and kind of working through kind of, like, I would say almost like kind of conceptually and emotionally and personally what it looks like to take back your power, if that makes sense. And I'll tell you what I mean by that is, like, if you think about kind of so many different kinds of scenarios where there's a problem, right? And then we don't like what's happening, right? Let me use Lytle Hall for an example, right? Lytle Hall, kind of like the building that I'm in, people have heard me talk about this before. We have ongoing kind of issues with mold and all sorts of problems with the building. But so I have a problem. Say, for example, I have sinus infections, persistent sinus infections. This is true for being in that building. And one thing that I can do, right, I could sit there where somebody asks me, what do you do about this? Well, I'm going to kind of, like, write to the dean, or I'm going to file this work order, or I'm going to write this scathing email to the president, or, you know, whatever it might be. Right. But the idea is that I'm going to appeal to somebody who's in authority and who's in power as it stands, right? And then hope that they do the right thing. I'm really what it comes down to, right? And if they don't act on it, right, there's a road. It's a pretty quick road to cynicism, right? Because, well, there's nothing that you can do, right? The sense of kind of hopelessness. And the thing that we don't often do, right, is instead of appeal to kind of the leadership, right, or appeal to the people in power, is that we turn to ourselves and say that we're going to do this ourselves, right? Asking, and so instead of asking permission from other people to just actually kind of go right ahead and organize and kind of make demands, right? And Barbara Maldaroni, but she, one of the things that she was always say, you know, said is like, look, we don't get anywhere, right, in a progressive movement. We don't get anywhere in terms of a working class movement. We don't get anywhere in this unless we're willing to talk about power. And knowing when you start talking about power, you're going to talk about conflict, right? And so it necessarily means that if you are going to take back power from the rank and file, from everyday people, just like we saw right now in Oakland, right? The strike, the teacher strike that's going there. We saw in Los Angeles. We saw in Chicago. We saw in West Virginia. We saw in Oklahoma. Those are all the results of rank and file caucuses, progressive caucuses of people getting together and say, we are going to transform our union. We are no longer going to talk about the union as being these people that we've elected into a leadership position and hoping that they're going to do the best thing for us. No, we're going to take power ourselves. And we're going to make demands not just on our bosses, but also upon our union leadership. And if our union leadership is not going to be responsive, right, to supporting organizing from the ground up, then we're going to replace the leadership, right? And that's what's happened in all these strikes that, you know, so many people want to hold up and as examples of like, this is what we should be doing. But if anybody's done any work within unions for any extended period of time, you know that unions are bureaucracies like any other thing, right? And there could be good ones and there could be bad ones, right? And the measure of how much a union, how much power a union has everything to do with how much the members are organized and prepared to take that power, right? The example that Barbara gave to about the West Virginia teacher strike, right? So the story that made it in the media was like once a teacher strike happened, right? They would interview the president of the AFT, right, in West Virginia, talk about you know, why they're on strike and all that kind of stuff. But what actually happened on the ground is that was teachers organized themselves to do that against the wishes and desires and without the permission of their union leadership, right? It was only once the teachers had organized and were prepared to strike that the union leadership realized like, oh, shit, we better get on board of this and we better start claiming that this is us, right? Otherwise, you know, the union's in trouble. So, you know, again, it's that story of organization. It's that story of direct action. It's that story of organizing for militancy and radical democracy in your union, in your workplace, in your organizations. That is kind of what gets the goods. So this is not going to be the first or the last of these workshops. I think it was really good, I think, for me, and I've talked to several other people that took part in this workshop from Kutztown and some of the other universities as part of the Pashi schools, and to just get a sense of what that actually means and where our own members are, even those members that say that, you know, we are interested in kind of having a much more democratic power militant union. What does that actually mean? And what does that mean in practice? Right. It means things like, for example, going to talk to other members. Right? You know, stuff like that. And, one of the stories I told there was I can remember when we were first organizing for graduate teachers and adjunct faculty at George Washington University when I lived in D.C. One of the things that surprised me, right, because, I mean, I've always been, as long as I can remember, kind of pro-union. I've been an activist and all this stuff. But when we first started to do organizing, right, the actual kind of work of labor organizing where you have to kind of get people to sign cards and say, hey, we want you to join this union and talk to them about this, I remember feeling very, very uncomfortable, right, kind of going up to people I didn't know, right, going up into other departments that were not my own and knocking on people's doors and say, hi, my name is Kevin Mahoney, and I'm in the English department here. I'm also part of this organizing effort, and I want to talk to you about a union, right? Saying this right now, right, on air and this recording, things like that, that's easy to do, right? But in the space of the workplace, we're not kind of trained or accustomed to that kind of interactions at work, by, and that's especially true, I think, in academics, but it happens right across the board. So to actually make that shift and kind of get, you know, with other people, get past that discomfort and say it's only in those conversations that we have with other people, the daily conversations we have with other people, that we can actually build that power. And really, you know, it's such a simple thing, but it's amazing to what extent and to what lengths people will go to avoid doing that particular thing, right? Just the basis of organizing. We can talk about structures. We can talk about, you know, ideologies. We can talk about living a conservative state. But really, have you talked to the person in the office next to you about this? About how you can organize for power? Nope. You know, and I'm not saying that was the response, but I mean, that is kind of, you know, part of the specifics that we did. So we went through, did a bunch of exercises, kind of worked through a little bit about this organizing model and so on, and it's kind of really amazing. So thanks to Barbara and for Labor Notes for just being the kind of go-to organization for rank and file union organizing that is so necessary. I'm going to put a plug in for their book, Secrets for a Successful Organizer. We used some of the handouts from that book during our workshop. And actually, when I was at the Labor Notes kind of conference in Philadelphia, 2 years ago, I guess now, we used, again, different parts of this book in terms of really thinking concretely about organizing. I know we have things like the Indivisible Guide and things like this that are out there, but I would strongly recommend picking up a copy of Secrets of Successful Organizer and folks. And they've got a great pamphlet out there, too, as well, by the way, that's organizing after Janus, right, after Janus decision. So it's pretty good. I've got a bunch of those things, too, as well, and we're going to have some kind of member giveaways coming up, too, as well, about the Janus thing as a little thank you goat. So anyway, Sean, anything else you got for PA Focus?
No, that's it.
No brand new kind of breaking news coming across your Twitter feed?
No, nothing PA related.
All right, man. All right. Well, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We're going to be back right after this with today's Let's Call. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. For the past 7 years, Raging Chicken Press has brought pull no punches, progressive reporting and commentary to the interwebs. Our long-form investigative pieces, stories that no access journalist wants to touch, or rollicking weekly podcasts strive to advance progressive movements and perspectives rooted in the struggles happening across the country or down the street. We've broken national stories and caused our share of discomfort in the halls of power. If we want a progressive future, we need progressive media. And you can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. We need to make sure to keep the movement in the media and the media in the movement. Best way you can do that is to become a member of Raging Chicken today by going to patreon.com/rcpress. Thank you for your energy, your encouragement, and your support. Keep up the fight.
Is a war-fighting domain, just like the land, air, and sea. We have the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Space Force. My new national...
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the Space Force is here! Welcome to Rage Chickens Out to Coop's Last Call! Space Force, space news, space news, space news. Thank you, Donald Trump, for Space Policy Directive number 4, which basically directs the Air Force to make a, well, by the Air Force and the military kind of in general, to establish the Space Force. Yes, it's official now. He signed the order. And where the hell the money's going to come from, how that's actually going to happen. You know, who the hell knows? But the rumor has it that it's going to be slow walked a little bit over there in the Pentagon, right? Maybe slow walk to 2020 or so. But it's pretty remarkable, I have to say. From going to what you just heard right there is the music coming in here. I haven't plugged this in a while, but it's you can check that out. It's a Space Force song. It's done by the group called the Gregory Brothers. You can check it out on YouTube. It's really, really funny. And that is basically – what's that?
In the 80s, right?
Space Force was actually – The actual show was in the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
And so they take that show, which I never saw, which is remarkable because I was like a sci-fi geek then as I am now. But but what you heard, what Donald Trump was saying there is like that was really kind of like the launch of the Space Force when he seemed to be kind of talking almost off the cuff and kind of making like kind of like a joke about like the Space Force. But then you could watch him as he was talking about it. He's like, Space Force. Yeah, that sounds really good. It sounds really good. And you heard him do it. And right now it's actually one step closer. Now, like, you know, you could laugh about it, could joke about it, but this is real, folks. And it's, like, frightening that it's real. And we'll see what actually happens. There's big sections. There's parts of the Air Force, at least, that have bought into this now, especially because it's basically, you know, the Marines are kind of, like, underneath the Navy, right? So they're a separate branch, but they're underneath the Navy. The Space Force is basically going to be a separate branch, but underneath the Air Force. Right. So with that comes resources and attention and a whole bunch of other stuff. And again, bureaucracies go where money is. So we'll see. We'll see where this goes. So I just thought that was amazing. I'm sitting there watching. I'm like, wow, this is crazy. So cool. And just as an echo with Kim Stanley Robinson's Red Moon, which I've talked about on this program before, Kim Stanley Robinson's Red Moon talks about the colonization of the moon. And it's really fascinating to kind of pair with real world developments with some of the things that's going on in that novel. But as you recall, a couple weeks back, China landed had a lander that kind of went down on the dark side of the moon. First time ever for the dark side of the moon. And they apparently are really ramping up their exploration and space program and looking very seriously about establishing kind of a moon colony or moon base or at least some sort of production there. And people are starting to say that is this kind of like the next space race? And it's looking close to it. As I said in the intro today, we've already have like the Space Policy Directive number one, strongly supported by Vice President Mike Pence, right, on Jim Bridenstine, who's the head of NASA. But is to actually send astronauts back to the moon by 2028. The other part of that story is that they're actually going to be sending what it looks like, if they're going to follow through on this, unmanned kind of both probes and delivery devices up there before then. So in other words, is that if it happens by 2028 that NASA sends astronauts back to the moon, there's going to be already structures, right, or at least beginnings of structures that are going to be in place, right, to set up kind of temporary habitats and that kind of stuff in some versions of it. So there you go, folks. We're going to the moon, right? Always wonders that, you know, so when it's a new moon, are we going to be able to kind of eventually kind of look up and see the lights on the moon, like where the moon bases are? I don't know.
Dude, I hear if you like squint hard enough, you might be able to see them driving around the lights.
That's what I heard. I got a telescope, man. So I'm going to go look. I'm waiting, man. I'm waiting.
I think this is like Space Force is just going to be like, it's a gimmick to get reelected.
I don't know. I don't think it's got traction to get reelected.
Yeah, like Matt Crisman, I think has just had a really good critique of this months ago on like Majority Report. Where he's like, this is just like a scam, like a shiny ball object to get people's like attention away from things.
I don't think it is. I think it's actually, look, there is a segment of it's mostly in the Republican Party, right? But it's also, it overlaps this libertarian stuff too as well, right? That is actually are 100% serious about this stuff. And Mike Pence is one of these people.
Monetizing space instead of like
totally no absolutely Right? How long have I come? The reason why we talk about space on this program is because of galactic capitalism. Like, this is what I've been saying since we started talking about space stuff in this program. It's like, that's why, right? It's because this is the next venture, like, for kind of galactic capitalists.
Instead of, like, dealing with climate change head on, we have business interests that would rather just, like, think that finding another fucking planet to live on.
Absolutely.
Is more feasible than.
Well, think about it like this, right? If you think about the role that kind of,
it's almost like it's an addict looking for the next high, pretty much.
That's like, exactly right. And what at the core of it, in many cases, so like NASA, like there's the one hand, there's the scientific, like most of what's happened in space thus far, right, has really been dominated by scientific exploration, right, and kind of trying to understand things more. Right, trying to understand like how planets work and all that kind of stuff, and that's really the vast majority of what, say, like NASA does, right, and what space programs have historically done. We're at the cusp at this place where they're starting to say, look, we can recognize, and there's people that are not dumb that are thinking we can recognize that we are running out of resources on this planet, right? We're destroying the planet. We're running out of resources whatsoever. So we have two choices, right? We can fundamentally change the way we do things. Green New Deal, or, right, we can double down on extractivism. But the problem is that we don't, like, we have kind of finite resources. So you have to find places where that's at. So you go to where the resource is at. And if you want to get to the asteroid belt to be able to mine those asteroids, like a lot of these people want to do, you have to have a moon base, right? Because you have to have a moon base because it's too expensive to launch those things just from Earth. Just saying. So you want to know the moon colony? You want to know where the next kind of like the round of kind of mass prison labor is going to go? It's going to go in the freaking moon factories. build the robots, right?
Would you be able to sweat up there? So really not. So it'll be good in working conditions.
You can sweat.
You can sweat in space.
Of course you can. You're inside a freaking spacesuit.
Or it's going to be like the Time Machine video movie. Was that? There was a movie called Time Machine. It was out like years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm going to look it up real quick. But at one point, I don't know if it was in Orson Welles. Here we go. It was out in 2002. I'm trying to see like what it was. H.G. Wells on his novel. So it was a play on his novel. And like at one point in the future, like, they get to the moon, right, as like this moon exploration project that leads to the destruction of the moon. It breaks up into like hundreds of pieces, like, because they destroy the moon. Like, that, yeah, like, that's where we're going down that road. Like, you look up in the sky and there's going to be like a moon just orbiting around the Earth like as a ring because we fucked it up.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we need a moon. I mean, I think we need a ring. I mean, you know, it'd be nice.
Yeah.
No, we imagine a piece of the moon come crashing down. That would suck.
I mean, that would probably end life as it is.
Yeah, I would say. Exactly. But
it's like Zelda.
Yeah, it's happening, though. I'm telling you, it's happening. But I could tell you one thing. I tell you one thing that the moon will not look like, and the people going to the moon will not look like. They will not look like Barbie. They will not look like Barbie. No, they will not. Even though Mattel, as I mentioned, they're launching in 2019, astrophysicist and astronaut Barbie. Right. This is like the third or fourth different version of Barbie that has kind of been an astronaut. There was the original one. There was like Mars Explorer and things like this too as well. But they're getting some little fanfare in the kind of edge thing. What's interesting about that? The only reason I bring that up and you kind of bring it in here. Because, you know, Mattel is responding to something, right? They're responding to a renewed interest in this kind of questions of space that they think that this is a time to kind of launch this out again too as well. So that's fascinating. So we'll see what goes on here. So yeah. And I was very happy to kind of like basically, you know, log into Facebook today and find that I had pictures of my daughter and I putting together the Saturn V Lego set, right? The NASA Apollo Saturn V rocket I guess today we finished like the first stage of something of the rocket, and it's all finished now. It's like kind of in our kind of window in our dining room and stuff. So, it's pretty freaking awesome. And I'm just going to say, so, and I just so you know, like I am completely aware, everybody, of all the contradictions that inhabit just what I've just said over the past about 5-6 minutes. Well, my absolute geek and love of space stuff and space exploration and all this kind of stuff. The fact that I'm always encouraging my kids to kind of think about NASA as a career. Just saying,
right? Make a moon capitalist.
Wait. Well, it's like, you know, again, it's like I'm like NASA as opposed to like, you know, Elon Musk or kind of Jeff Bezos as the thing, but you know, who knows? By the time they get to that point, you know, who the hell knows what everything's going to look like? They're going to end up, you know, working for the Space Force or something crazy. Good news and beer today, everybody. I am actually usually the Free Will is putting out their beer releases on Saturdays now, which is I guess good for them, right? But it's always, I'm always doing 1,001 other things on Saturdays, so it's like I usually do not make the time for myself to go over there. But today, right, after I get done with the podcast and stuff, got a little time before the kids get home, right? Got about a half an hour window between the time that Free Will opens by the time I need to get to the bus, and that's when I do normally when I used to do those are the beer runs, right, to go get new releases. And I'm very, very excited that they got the 5th of May, right, is out today, and it is a sour ale aged in tequila barrels. With key limes and Himalayan salt. It's really, really good. It's I love it. Absolutely love it. But one of my all-time favorites, and this is when Free Will, if anybody's been to Free Will Brewing where it is now, it's got a beautiful tap room, kind of got windows open up nicely into the actual brewery itself. There's actually tables and like picnic tables and things like that. There's a separate bar that's kind of in the actually the brewing space. And it's just an awesome kind of like physical space. The one out at I always forget the name, but what's that place where their second what's that?
It's Village.
Peddler's Village. Yeah, that, have you been out there? That tap room is beautiful, right? So I mean, there's all that kind of stuff. But when Free Will first started, right, it was in the basement. That's in the same building. But it was in the basement of this kind of warehousey place that hadn't been occupied in a long time. And it was dank, right? And it was kind of like the sticky floor.
Barber chair.
What's that?
The barber chair.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was like the barber chair. That's right, the barber chair. I mean, it was like, it was kind of the, you go down there, it's great, and he stacks a beer. It was like, you know, in this working space. And one of the first growlers I got from there was SafeWord. Right. Because I saw it, I'm like, mango habanero. That sounds like right up my speed. And
give me a growler of that, please.
Yeah, exactly.
And like, all right.
That's what I did. That's what I did. And they're like, really? I'm like, yes. Right. And so the fact that it's out in cans now is, you know, just kind of like one of these markers for kind of how that organization, how that business has developed. So I will be picking up some SafeWord today. That's for sure. So it's a nice, it's a little nice and hefty on the alcohol, 10.4% ABV. And it's the kind of thing where it just tastes really good, right? It's a really good Imperial IPA, tastes really good. You get the sweetness of the mangoes, and then the habanero kind of kicks in last to follow it up. Just luxurious. But enough about me. It was a really important week, actually. It was really, it was a mile marker of sorts, historic, if you will. You know, rather than narrate this from a third person perspective, why don't you give us the historic first person look at the legend that was the return?
I went back to Pizza Boy this weekend.
Oh!
Visit on Sunday afternoon.
So this, just for everybody out there, no, this is your first visit back to Pizza Boy since you left.
Yes, which was last April.
Right. And we could say, I think it's fair to say, you didn't exactly...
It was a bit unceremonious.
Yeah, you didn't leave on the best terms, as somebody saw it. You got a little upset on your leaving. You weren't so happy about how you left, maybe. But let's just say there was an incident. but and that's kept you away from there for a while.
Yeah.
I still have this moment of like the Sean Kitchen is like the Popeye version of Sean Kitchen, right? It's like this. I've taken all I can stands and I can't stands no more.
First of all, I've been busy a lot the past year. I'm finally doing work where I actually want to do work.
Yeah.
And it's like, you can get stressed out very easily working a job, you know, for like it's $12 or $15 an hour. Like, this is why, to me, $15 an hour is still not a comparable minimum wage.
Right.
Because, like, you're working in a job that you're barely making the bills and stress mounts up, and got into a bit of an argument.
Well, let's put it like this, right? Your point is well taken, right? Is that you're sitting there and you're barely being able to kind of scrape by, right? Even like at that amount. And so, like in a great scenario, if you got a workplace that is kind of well run and people help each other out and it's a good thing, it's like at least it makes the work like manageable, right? Even though you have to do that. When you start putting in kind of crappy managers. Right. And kind of like, you know, when workers are not treated like fairly or not treated the way that they should be, then it's the recipe for disaster.
And I mean, I got out of there and I mean, sort of embarrassed what happened. But no, you have to like bury those, you know, bury the hatchet. And, you know, I just want, you know, it's like, say if I do go back in there, I don't want to be like, it being like that holy shit moment, like the first time back in. So more of like inoculate that. And yeah. I mean, I'm still friends with a lot of people that work there, and you know, a lot of people were there on Sunday are people I'm friends with. And you know, it was fun going in there for a bit.
So here's the question. Here's the big question. The big question is, what kind of beer did you get?
I got a New England double IPA. And then I got a 6-pack of spandex glitter and egos to go.
Ooh, 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 ooh. Did it feel good to have the beer again?
Yeah, because a lot – I will admit here, like, I mean, they're doing the best beer out here in Pennsylvania regardless of what's around. I mean, Trogues and Evergreen's good, but, yeah, Pizza Boy's beer is just, like, on point. I mean, it's – like, it's literally, like, a well-run machine at this point. It's just everything is dialed in. You can try anything on that board for the first time, and it'll be good. Like, you're not going to get a bad beer from them.
So,
which is always nice.
Well, you know, I'm excited. I, you know, personally, selfishly, right? I'm very happy that you went back in there. So now maybe we could do some legit beer exchanges again. It's total selfishly on that one.
No, I totally, now that I'm actually affording the stuff.
Exactly.
I could treat you to some stuff I've been falling behind.
All I'm saying is, man, sunny side up. Sunny.
I think my mom's in that same camp as well.
Oh, really? Really? Yeah. I still go back to that. Is one that one time you got me this sunny side up? What had like what vanilla bean and
cinnamon?
Yep. That
peppers in it.
What's that?
Peppers.
Peppers. Yeah, yeah. That beer was probably one of my favorite beers I've ever had in my life. It was just so good.
Yeah, I'm like sort of surprised they haven't done that type of version of it yet in cans. Mm-hmm. Because like there's a really good like Mexican cake out there, which is pretty much a coffee stout. It's down by like I think it's Westbrook. Mm-hmm. Mexican cake, which is down in Charlottesville, South Carolina. Yeah, it's in Charlotte. Yeah. Charleston. It's in Charleston.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm trying to like think. It's in Charleston. And they do a lot of like really good, they have a really good goza, but it's a coffee stout. They really popularize the style with like cinnamon, hot peppers, and vanilla beans in it.
Yeah.
And coconut nibs. And Pizza Boy did a really good, fancy version of that with their sunny side up.
Yeah. Yeah. They really did. Really did. That's some good stuff.
And they haven't made it since. I'm pissed.
Well, hey.
And also, like, the Eternal Sunshine came back on tap for the first time. Mm-hmm. And, like, kind of just like, favorite beer.
Yeah. So, well, congratulations about making your way back. You know, from what I heard, right, because I heard through the grapevine that when you walked in, people were like, oh, like people were like standing up, clapping and stuff.
Yes. No, I literally ran into like a bunch of customers that I used to serve all the time.
Yeah.
And there was a there were some Senate Republican staffers standing at the bar a couple of them I lifted the gym with in the mornings. And like everyone started cheering like behind the bar, like, oh, it's Kitchen. And they're just like, the one guy goes, celebrity bartending tonight, eh? I'm just like, yeah, I don't think that's happening.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, crazy. Well, cool. Pizza Boy Homecoming. Mark it on your calendars, everybody. This is going to be something that is that we're going to celebrate each year. So it's an important moment in the history of Sean's and Pizza Boy. So cool. Well, hey man, anything else good for the order?
No.
No.
Well, Robert Kraft just got arrested.
Who?
Robert Kraft.
Who's Robert Kraft? I'm drawing
a the owner of the Patriots.
He did for what?
Going into a Florida salon parlor and walking into a prostitution ring.
Oh, there you go. Hey, nothing but good people in the NFL, I'll tell you.
There's a couple of them in southeastern Pennsylvania. You might have a tip on a couple of them.
Oh.
Might even see some legislators there, I'm not sure, but we'll see.
Heads up on that one, folks. All right, man. Well, hey, have yourself an awesome week, and may the weather kind of finally break. It looks like spring is on the horizon. I don't want to jinx it, but... this has been a crappy winter. It's been a crappy like 8 months, right, of weather. So I'm just hoping that we got some sunny days ahead of us, and you know, the organizing kits up. Cool. Well, and Sean's gonna try to get better. All right, man. Well, hey, have a good week.
I will. You too.
All right.
I have more beer reports for you next week, then.
Awesome. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll talk to you next week, everybody.
See ya!
One more time for Daryl, everybody.
Just to be on record, I enjoy my vegetables, and plants need CO2. So I want to make sure we still have plenty of CO2 out there so we have green grass and green vegetables growing, because we need CO2. We can't eliminate all CO2. So I think... We're going to have an interesting debate for those that want to produce something that's actually needed by our environment, claiming that they're improving the environment.
Oh, he tore up the CO2 agenda.
Zit.
Oh, cool, man.